From Michigan to Texas, Louisiana to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration has heeded bipartisan calls to end the import of Russian oil. Amir Hanjani from the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is here to explain the impact. A massive omnibus spending bill is making its way through Congress, bringing action on funding the federal government for the current fiscal year to a close. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Adding a ban on the import of oil to economic sanctions against Russia was a vital step in preserving American integrity. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns why from Philip Rossetti of the R Street Institute. And Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds impressed many with her response to the State of the Union address. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council says recent tax reforms in Iowa are also impressive. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The drop in oil and natural gas production during the COVID-19 pandemic is a larger factor in the current increase in gasoline prices than the newly enacted ban on Russian imports. For details, we turn to Amir Hanjani. He is a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Amir, welcome to American Radio Journal. Amir, the United States has now placed an embargo on oil imported from Russia. Tell us a bit about this embargo. What impact will this have on Russia and on its ability to continue its invasion of the Ukraine?
It's not going to have a material impact on Russia's military strategy, because Russia's military strategy in Ukraine, as we can see, isn't really affected by U.S. or European sanctions so far. They're pressing ahead. And you have to believe that Vladimir Putin and those around Vladimir Putin, great deal of experience with the West the last 30 years since the fall of the Soviet Union, have sort of priced this in a way, baked it into the cake that there was going to be a very strong Western reaction to his invasion of Ukraine. And as far as the U.S. goes, it doesn't really materially impact us, because we weren't really getting much oil from Russia. And in fact, we get no gas from Russia. So it's a symbolic measure. It certainly turns up the temperature a little bit, but it doesn't really affect the psychology of Vladimir Putin as something like Europe embargoing oil and gas from Russia, because that would really hurt his pocketbook and hurt his ability to finance the war, because Europe is such a large consumer of Russian oil and gas.
We, of course, had rising gasoline prices, Amir, before this embargo on Russia was put in effect. Were those rising prices part of the market anticipating this move, or was this part of the inflationary cycle that we were already experiencing?
It's all of the above. This gets a little bit complicated, because most people, when they go, like I go and I go pump my gas, and look at the price and you say, wow, you know, that's really high. Why is it so high? The price of oil and gas isn't determined so much by supply and demand, whereas we say, okay, the reason why the price of oil is high is because there isn't that much supply out there. That's not the case here. There's plenty of supply out there. And Russian oil and gas is not embargoed to the rest of the world, just the United States. What's affecting the prices is of oil and gas right now is speculation and geopolitical risk. And the market is pricing that in. They don't really know what's going to happen in Ukraine and beyond Ukraine. And so they're anticipating a period of great deal of instability in the globe. And this instability is making traders speculate the price of oil is going to be higher in the future. And that's all that is right now, right? They believe the price of oil is going to be higher because of geopolitical speculation, geopolitical intrigue, what you see in Ukraine currently. And so that's why you see the Biden administration is making moves to try and change that narrative geopolitically by possibly reaching a nuclear deal with Iran, possibly bringing Venezuela back in from the cold, and bringing their oil back online.
Well, this whole idea of continuing to rely on undependable foreign sources. Certainly, Iran and Venezuela both fit that definition. Is the Biden administration giving any consideration to reversing what is essentially a war on fossil fuels production domestically so that we could produce our own and not have to go to Russia, Venezuela, Iran, Saudi Arabia, or anywhere else for that matter?
These are two different points, and it's a very, very good question. First of all, the U.S. is the largest producer of energy in the world. That's been a trend that's been going on since the George W. Bush administration started and on through Obama, Trump, Obama 1, Obama 2, and then Trump, and now to Biden. The Keystone Pipeline gets a lot of headlines because President Biden has stopped that. But as far as everything else goes, sort of continued that train of allowing U.S. energy producers to drill for oil, drill for gas. The reason why we are not at peak capacity right now as far as our production is because the price was so low and during the pandemic, and many companies that were looking to for people to come and work in the patch, so to speak, weren't finding those employers willing to come. Now the price has shot up and we're coming out of the pandemic. My guess is, and what everything that I'm seeing from Washington is that the U.S. is going to start ramping up production again. Companies don't want to frack, don't want to drill for oil when the price is, you know, 40, 50 bucks a barrel. They want to drill for it when the price is, you know, 80, 90, 100 bucks a barrel. Why is that? Capitalism. You know, they want to make money. They want to make money for themselves. They want to make money for the shareholders. But even if we were drilling and producing at max capacity right now, that doesn't mean the prices of oil at the pump would be any different. Because, as I said, it's Wall Street traders and speculators who trade on this price. And they're trading on psychology and they're trading on geopolitical risk right now.
Although I know you don't have a crystal ball, Amir, as we go through the coming weeks and months, is it likely that the cost of oil, the cost of a barrel of oil, the cost of gasoline at the pump is going to continue to remain relatively high?
I wish I knew that answer. I'd go place that bet. I don't know the answer, but I could sort of tell you how to give you sort of a construct to begin to understand the question, how to look to answer it. If we get a nuclear deal with Iran and their oil comes online, anywhere between 1 to 3 million barrels, we wouldn't import any of that oil. There's a ban on U.S. importing oil from Iran, but others around the world would, like Asia, like Europe. Same thing with Venezuela. If we were to strike a diplomatic deal with them and bring that oil online as well, that would have a downward pressure on oil prices because now the market's saying, okay, we're seeing more supply come online that could possibly substitute for some Russian production if Europe were to start to wean themselves away from Russian oil.
We have been talking with Amir Hanjani, who is a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And Amir, tell us a bit about the Quincy Institute. Also, where can folks go to visit you online?
The Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is a think tank that was founded in 2019. It takes a realist and a restraint-oriented approach to foreign policy. The website is www.quincyinstitute.org.
Quincyinstitute.org. Amir Hanjani of the Quincy Institute. Amir, thank you for taking time to be with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's been keeping an eye on the U.S. budget and federal spending and all those good things which have gone on for an extended period of time. Now we have some action. Scott, good to have you here today.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
It's called an omnibus, and this isn't something that you get into to ride from point A to point B, but in some ways, taxpayers do get taken for a ride, don't they?
Yeah, well, this time they tried to call the bill the Consolidated Appropriations Act. And this was legislation that basically funds the entire federal government and the part of the government that is discretionary in nature. This is what Congress has to fund every single year. We obviously have the main entitlement programs that are mandatory spending programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then about 100 different anti-poverty welfare benefit programs that are automatically funded every year. But what Congress passed this week was an omnibus appropriations that takes all 12 of the subcommittees and loads it into one bill. And this bill in particular was 2,741 pages of goodies.
Let's back up a little bit here, Scott. The federal budget year runs from October 1 to the end of September the next year. We are now in the month of March. Why is all this occurring in the month of March when the budget was due back on October 1st?
Yeah, well, this is actually sort of deja vu to 2018. The same thing happened then. Congress operated underneath what was known as a continuing resolution, and a continuing resolution establishes an appropriations level at the previous authorized level. So that basically meant that underneath the CR, we were funding government the exact same way that we were funding it underneath Donald Trump. And so for the first year of Biden, we did not have an appropriations agreement. They were doing the CR, and they were also putting in supplemental emergency spending. But for the most part, we had the CR that extended us into September 30th. Then we had a CR that put us into December leading up to Christmas. And then they punted the CR once again to February 18th. And then that February 18th CR expired this week. So a bunch of really band-aids that were put on the federal budget to make sure that we didn't have a partial government shutdown. But ultimately what that did was it gave the appropriators the political window they needed to get the votes to pass a massive appropriations bill. And this bill did have one big anomaly in it. It was $13.6 billion in supplemental funding to support Ukraine. And a lot of members of Congress looked at that as sort of the engine that was going to pull along a long train of spending when it comes to the rest of the federal government.
Is this a case of never letting a good crisis go to waste?
Well, we know that that's typically the MO from Nancy Pelosi, and she's certainly used COVID relief as linchpin for getting enactment of federal appropriations previously. I do agree that the Ukrainian situation is terrible. We all seen the photos and the videos and the news reports that are emerging there and potential war crimes and whatnot. But the bottom line is that was such a small percentage of an overall bill that is spending over $1.5 trillion. And when the U.S. economy is, I think, on almost life support, you know, record level of inflation in 40 years, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, I'm sure, but we're also dealing with unemployment fracturing from the coronavirus pandemic, and a lot of people just haven't gotten back to work. So we're seeing supply chain shortages. We obviously know what the vaccine mandates are doing to workers, and the bottom line is that the federal government just voted to fund vaccine mandates again in this bill as well.
So the fiscal folly continues at the federal government level. And another thing that is continuing, Scott, is, as you hinted about here a couple of minutes ago, inflation 7.9% in February. That's a 40-year high. Your take on that number and its impact?
Yeah, this is the highest level since January 1982. And the way that they provide for an annualized number on inflation is you look back to the previous year's February report, and we're 7.9% ahead of that. And we know that we've had a pretty terrible month when it comes to rising costs within the United States, especially related to energy. But food costs are also moving sharply higher during the month of February, and we've got a lot of contributors that are resulting in this, I hate to say it, but it is a terrible economic situation for many Americans. It's a crunch on everybody that thought that they had strong wage growth over the Trump administration. All that's being reversed because inflation is a hidden tax on U.S. consumers. And so workers' paychecks are falling farther behind, and that's also contributing to about 2.6% of the decline over the past year.
As we look then at this rising inflation, everybody is feeling the pinch from food to gasoline, as you pointed out. Is this going to have a political impact as the midterm election year really hits high gear now?
When I think about a wave election, and we have had some wave elections recently in history, right? There was a big wave election in 1994 with the contract with America and the Gingrich Revolution. We also had a wave election in 2010 with the Tea Party movement. And both of those wave elections were largely sprung on the American electorate through things that Washington was doing and things that were sort of out of the control of states. We look at what the main events have been that have sort of set back President Biden's political capital. Number one, certainly the debacle of the withdrawal in Afghanistan. Number two, you look at all the levels of federal spending, all the money that he spent last year, and what that did is a contributing factor to inflation. We've pumped $7 trillion into the economy since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. So, you know, I kind of wonder, what are the other major events that happen over the next 7 months prior to the November elections? Is there anything that can really get Biden back on track? In terms of the economy, I don't think that inflation's going away by November. In terms of the broken, inept process that's happening in Washington, I don't think that Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer are able to reverse that trend either. And so we have a real situation in our hands where Republicans are continuing to add to the wave election, not to take away from it or to mitigate our gains. The only thing that gives Democrats any hopes are redistricting in some of these blue states where they've solidified seats.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, ending as we usually do with a few words about the club.
Yeah, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our group is united in this idea of economic freedom and liberty. If you want to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org. You can become a member for free. Join 525,000 other Americans that have already done that.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The ban on importing Russian oil was consistent with other economic sanctions imposed by the Biden administration. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Philip Rossetti at the R Street Institute.
Well, the war in Ukraine is grinding on this week, and so too are sanctions that have been imposed on Russia from not just the United States, but at this point, much of the world. And the latest news on that front was the decision just earlier this week by the Biden administration to cut off the importing of Russian oil. And that is, of course, the latest blow, perhaps the biggest blow taken against Vladimir Putin's regime so far by the Western world in the economic response to the invasion of Ukraine. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is here to talk about this decision to stop importing Russian oil. He is Philip Rossetti. He is a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute, and he joins us now to talk about this. Philip, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Philip, of course, was the author of a now prescient piece that ran, you can find this at rstreet.org, ran on Monday of this week. And the headline there was, "Yes, Mr. President, you need to stop importing Russian oil." I guess the Biden administration is listening to you, Philip.
It's great to know I've got such high quality leadership, I guess, or readership. So always happy to make a difference. But yes, this was something that the administration had been toying with. They've been reluctant to actually move ahead with banning Russian energy imports, whereas Congress in both the Senate and the House, and in a bipartisan sense, were really pushing for it. So glad to see some unity on this front finally.
We import, or I should say imported, quite a bit of oil from Russia. You go through the numbers in the piece here, but then you say, and this is what really caught my eye here, you say that really, actually, this isn't about the oil at all. Tell us a little bit about that. What is this really about?
One thing that might be helpful to understand is kind of the lay of the land. Russian energy imports are, you know, really about 3% of our total sort of supply domestically, and even less than that if you're only looking at crude oil. And then for Russia itself, we're only about 1% of their crude oil exports. The bigger message here, though, is not so much about trying to deal a blow to Russia, but about preserving U.S. credibility in the international stage. Sanctioning everything except energy is just sending this message to the rest of the world that the U.S. cares about nation sovereignty, cares about international norms and human rights, but only as long as it doesn't affect gas prices. So now that the administration has finally said, yes, we are going to include these in our sanctions regime, it is showing that we are serious about it, and we do hope to hold other nations accountable for war crimes and violations of international law.
This is a situation where, of course, the United States sits on a large reserve of energy ourselves, and that that makes these decisions, I mean, not that these are easy, but maybe it does make these decisions a little bit easier.
One would think. It's a little interesting in this regard because U.S. oil production or oil and petroleum production together, I should say, is still below our pre-pandemic levels. So when we think about what we could be doing to fill this gap, you know, we certainly could produce enough oil to fill any sort of supply disruption from Russia, at least domestically we could. But it is something that the administration seems to have been reluctant to do. And I think they've had a lot of early moves where they've been pushing renewable energy and clean energy alternative fuels. And I don't know if they really want to admit that those moves might have been a little bit premature.
We're talking with Philip Rossetti. He's a senior fellow for energy policy at the R Street Institute. Philip, I guess we can't have a discussion about energy policy and oil policy without talking about gas prices, which are obviously on the rise, higher than they've maybe ever been at this point. What is the right approach here, or what steps would you recommend the Biden administration take now? We've said, okay, we're going to stop importing Russian oil. That probably means yet another spike in gas prices. How do they navigate that politically, or how should they navigate that?
Well, there's a few levers at the administration's disposal. One is the near-term sort of release of reserves from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, though that's, you know, really not going to be a big play in moderating long-term prices. The best thing the administration can do is to try to ease as many sort of opportunities for increased production on public land. That's where the administration probably has the most impact. There's also these opportunities for improving the sort of the approval for like LNG export terminals and things where you can get more investment in this, in the oil and gas sector, where they're like, hey, you know, we actually can sell this. But if you have, you know, constant barriers to new production, that's going to be a bigger challenge. And we kind of saw that with the beginning of the administration. They ended the Keystone pipeline approval. They, you know, have put in new processes in place for LNG export terminal construction. And they've also been, they had a moratorium on new oil and gas leases on public land. What I do think that the administration is doing, which I'm not sure is going to be a wise move necessarily, is they're going to, you know, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, even Iran, to try and increase their output. But that might not yield much effort because, one, we, this kind of gets back to the problem of trying to sanction Russia, and you don't want to necessarily legitimize all of our rivals just to punish Russia. But also those countries have an interest in seeing oil prices remain high. They're part of OPEC. They want to constrain their own production to force prices to become artificially high. So I'm not sure if trying to get everyone else to increase production is going to get the best near-term impact, but that is something that they, you know, are trying to do.
Yeah, a tricky situation for sure. But of course, as you said at the outset, really the important thing here is setting this clear example that the United States is serious about these sanctions on Russia and preserving the norms of international sovereignty here, recognizing that Russia has crossed a clear line in going into Ukraine. And this proves that the United States' response, I think, is serious. That's an important point in all of this, but it does mean, of course, higher prices at the pump, or may mean higher prices at the pump. Philip Rossetti, thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is Philip Rossetti. He is a resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute. You can check out his latest piece at rstreet.org. Mr. President, you need to stop importing Russian oil. And hey, as I said at the top, the Biden administration has taken that advice, and we're on to the next phase of this sort of slow boiling economic conflict with Russia. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of that and everything going on in domestic politics at reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Led by Governor Kim Reynolds, the state of Iowa has enacted a number of pro-taxpayer reforms. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
For many federal political observers, a new conservative star was born earlier this month as Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds gave an impressive rebuttal to President Joe Biden's State of the Union address. However, for those of us fortunate enough to work with the hardworking men and women who lead state-level public policy discussions, Governor Kim Reynolds, an ALEC alumnus, has been a free market star for quite some time, as she has been working hard for years to deliver key policy wins for the citizens of Iowa while at the state capitol in Des Moines. As Governor Reynolds helpfully reminded the folks inside the Beltway the other day, we need to step outside of the D.C. bubble. Moreover, lost in the excitement of the State of the Union, or more specifically, Governor Reynolds' rebuttal, the mainstream media missed an important news story. Earlier in the day, Governor Reynolds had signed one of the largest tax cuts in Iowa's history and the most consequential tax reform to pass anywhere across America so far this year. In fact, Iowa's success might very well start a new Heartland tax rebellion, where lawmakers in surrounding states like Wisconsin, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Missouri, just to name a few, quickly realize they need to keep up with Iowa or risk falling behind by standing still. Since the start of the year, Governor Reynolds has worked hard and hand-in-hand with stalwart free market leaders in the legislature to get the job done. As House Speaker Pro Tem John Wills said, quote, "The time to make Iowa more competitive with transformational tax reform is now, with the excess funds in our coffers. Tax reform will make Iowa more competitive, but more importantly, it's the right thing to do for the citizens of Iowa." The Iowa tax reform plan created a flat tax for individuals and also provided substantial relief to both individual and business taxpayers. The new law will lower the personal income tax rate to 3.9% in coming years, while also gradually reducing the business tax rate and repealing state taxes on retirement income altogether. As a result of years of fiscal conservatism, Iowa's fiscal foundation going into the tax reform debate was sound. For instance, entering 2022, Iowa's budget was running a $1.2 billion surplus, and the reserves were full. As a result, their taxpayer relief fund had over $1 billion for income tax reductions, and that fund is expected to increase by close to another billion by the end of this year. Governor Reynolds and conservatives in the legislature deserve real credit for prudent budgeting in recent years that really set the stage for this impressive tax reform win. Even prior to the COVID-19 pandemic and resulting federal funds, Iowa's fiscal house was in strong condition. As a result of Governor Reynolds really wisely working to keep Iowa's economy open during the pandemic, the state's economic recovery was quick. Iowa was one of the states that passed a tax reform bill in 2021 and has been one of the first out of the gate this year as well. This is a virtuous result following fiscally conservative policies. Iowa's economic outlook rank was 33 in the latest edition of Rich States, Poor States, the Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index. However, with recent tax changes, Iowa could potentially move up all the way to number 18 in the rankings. This would be one of the largest improvements in the nearly 15-year Rich States, Poor States history. Data from Rich States, Poor States confirms that positive migration patterns towards low-tax states, and particularly states with flat taxes and states that go without personal income taxes altogether. For instance, the no-income tax states have outperformed their high-tax counterparts in terms of key economic measures of success, like wage growth, population growth, and income growth. And just look at the millions of Americans continuing to vote with their feet away from high-tax states like New York, Illinois, and California, and towards free market and limited government states like Florida and Texas. Iowa is following the successful footsteps of states like North Carolina and Indiana, among many others that have lowered their tax rates while still providing for the priorities of government. As you can tell by listening to her speech, Governor Reynolds and legislators in Iowa are placing Iowa taxpayers first with their tax reform efforts. Expect more good things from Iowa and Governor Reynolds in the years to come, both in Iowa and perhaps even on the national stage. For more information on tax cuts and economic competitiveness across the states, go to richstatespoorstates.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KTIA-FM in Des Moines, Iowa, WWSM-AM in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, along with KEST-AM in San Francisco, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.